About a dozen people sit in a semicircle. They range in age from their 60s to almost 100. There's a lot going on in the room. Tables covered in games, pet birds hopping around in a cage, an old movie playing in the background. It's time for chair exercises. We've stopped in on a day program for dementia and Alzheimer's patients at Village Shalom. People here are at all different stages in their condition, but they clearly perk up during this particular activity.
These are adults that we're talking about. These are not children. These are people that have had families, jobs, education. It's a social club, and it really is a social club. We have a lot of men that sit and talk and play games together, and a lot of our women sit and talk about the men.
Exercise is just one of the activities. There's also bingo and painting and socializing.
We do a lot of reminiscing. Most of the time, short-term memory is not there. So we discuss TV shows and activities from the past. We do a lot of singing, songs from the 30s, 40s, 50s, even the 60s.
I'm Gina Kaufman, and today we're talking about Alzheimer's disease, something that's expected to affect more and more Americans as our population ages. Later in the show, we'll hear personal stories about living with Alzheimer's as a patient or relative. But for now, let's hear about research. Dr. Jeffrey Burns joins us from KU Med, where he's a professor of neurology. Hi, Jeff. Welcome to Central Standard.
Hi, Gina. Thanks for having me.
What are some of the most recent developments in Alzheimer's research? Do we understand the disease better today than we did 5-10 years ago?
Oh, definitely. I mean, we are really progressing forward in terms of our understanding of Alzheimer's disease. We're also progressing forward in terms of our understanding of how to diagnose it better. And we're making strides in the research arena towards developing treatments that may slow the disease process or stop it. So it's an exciting time for Alzheimer's research. Now, having said that, we haven't yet translated those treatments into the clinic yet, but we think we're on the verge.
When you talk about getting better at diagnosing Alzheimer's, what does that mean, and what effect does that have?
Well, so the diagnosis of Alzheimer's is currently, it's a low-tech diagnosis. We make it primarily based on information that we gather from the patient and the family. So it comes down to what's been changing and how have things been changing.
So it's like anecdotal?
Yeah, in a sense, yes. We're looking for evidence of the presence of a progressive, cognitive change, memory and thinking changes. And we can find that evidence from family members. We can find it from testing, cognitive testing, memory and thinking testing. If you read the papers and follow the Alzheimer's literature, there's a lot of high-tech advances that are going on in the research area. But, we at this point, the diagnosis is really made on the low-tech information. Now, having said that, we do brain scans, we do lab tests, but we primarily do those tests to rule things out, to rule out stroke or tumor, things like that that can cause memory changes. But where we're headed is a direction where we can see changes in the brain linked to Alzheimer's, the molecular changes of Alzheimer's in the brain, amyloid plaques and tangles.
Can you explain what those are?
So those are microscopic changes that we can see in the brain in people who have Alzheimer's disease. So under the microscope, we can see that, we see amyloid plaque buildup, which is just a protein that we can see under the microscope, and then tangles, which are brain cells that are filled with a protein called tau. Those are changes that we've known about for over 100 years.
Really?
Dr. Alzheimer first described them in 1904. And suggested that they were related to the disease. And so we've been looking at them under the microscope for 100 years. But what's happened in the last 10 years is new technology that allows us to see those types of changes in the brain in life, in living people.
So how does that change the diagnosis process? I mean, can you Are there people who maybe have Alzheimer's who we don't realize that because the anecdotal evidence isn't pointing in that direction? Does it allow us to detect it faster?
Well, so at this point, the answer to your question is it hasn't yet sort of changed our clinical practice. So the short answer is it hasn't yet made the big change that we're expecting from these techniques, and primarily because we don't have the research yet that shows that it improves diagnosis and changes outcomes for patients. It makes them healthier by our treatments. So where are we headed? We're headed in a direction, in the next 5 years probably, where we're doing studies that will help us understand how do we use these tests in clinical practice to make a more definitive diagnosis, to better understand what's causing the cognitive changes. We could talk a long time about this, but right now Medicare doesn't pay for those tests if we order them in the clinic. Insurance companies don't pay for them, so we're kind of held back by that. They don't pay for them right now because we haven't shown that if we have that information, does it alter treatment? Does it alter patient outcomes? So we're starting big national studies that are designed to test that idea.
How do you test outcomes without implementing it first?
Well, we would implement in a research/clinical setting, and that would be the plan. In the next year, we will likely start in our clinic. We'll join a national effort that the Alzheimer's Association is involved in. That is designed to test, if we add this information to a clinician's, arsenal of tests, does it improve the diagnosis? Does it improve the outcomes? So that's sort of the long answer to your question. We think in the next 5 to 10 years, we're going to use these tests to better classify individuals and the cognitive changes and understand what's the underlying biology of that person's cognitive change, and then target treatments for it. If it's more amyloid-based, we might need amyloid drugs. If it's more tau-based, we might need tau drugs. I think our understanding of Alzheimer's will move forward, as well as, at the same time, our treatments, which will be better targeted. And then one other thing you implied was, what about people who don't have cognitive changes? Do they have these types of changes in the brain? And what we found is about 1 out of 3 totally healthy, cognitively normal individuals will have amyloid plaques in their brain, despite having no memory changes. And what we think this suggests, or what we think this implies, is that person's at higher risk for Alzheimer's disease. They don't have the disease. They won't necessarily get the disease, but they're at higher risk. And so we know that amyloid plaques build up 10 to 15 years before the onset of memory problems. So we see that as a window of opportunity to identify somebody at higher risk and then develop prevention strategies to try to ward off the disease or the memory problems that may come.
This disease is so personal, and even just listening to you talk about the diagnosis process right now, even that is so personal. Like, it's the people who you have the closest relationships with who are essentially providing the doctor with the information that can lead to a diagnosis. Is that unusual?
I suppose it probably is unusual, but I mean, really, where we are right now is the best detector of the earliest changes of Alzheimer's disease is an attentive family member. That's where we are right now. In 5 years, we believe we're going to have better detectors through our technology, through our new imaging technology, where we can see these amyloid plaques and tangles building up before the onset of any memory problems, and giving us that window of opportunity to intervene, to do something that may delay the onset or prevent it.
You are the co-director of KU's Alzheimer's Disease Center, which I understand is one of only 29 research facilities dedicated to the study of Alzheimer's in the country.
That's right. Yeah, so we're one of the National Institute of Aging designated Alzheimer's centers, which means we've got a lot of different things going on, from drug development efforts to drug testing, clinical trials, to our own research, our own clinical trials, where we're studying things like, can we use exercise to delay or prevent Alzheimer's disease?
What sparked your personal interest in Alzheimer's? I mean, as a scientist.
Well, my interest, I don't have a personal story to tell that sort of drew me in, but it is a personal thing for me. I mean, I saw this as a huge opportunity as a neurologist and somebody interested in behavior and what makes us human and the mysteries of the brain. Alzheimer's is the disease that that affects all those things. It's also an enormous opportunity, I think, to make an impact because it's such a huge problem. Our treatments, we do have treatments, but they're not good enough. We need to make big strides forward in terms of better treating the disease and preventing the disease. And so it's a huge challenge, and which I see as a huge opportunity to make an impact.
Is there like a specific question about Alzheimer's that's driving your team's research?
So we're our center, we do have a scientific theme, and it's really revolves around metabolism. So the cellular metabolism of the brain cells, we think that's defective in Alzheimer's disease.
Can you define cellular metabolism for the layperson? Because I think most people think of metabolism as like, can you eat a lot and still be skinny? And I think that's not what you're talking about.
No, but related. So it's kind of how do the cells use energy? How do they use glucose? How do they use the food we're eating? And, you know, we know there are problems that the way the cells use the fuel is defective in Alzheimer's disease, and we think that is a big clue. And so if you look at our research portfolio of all the things that we're doing, you know, the theme of exercise, diet, and then our drug development efforts is really focused on can we use those as a way to influence the metabolism of the brain cells? Can we rev up the brain cells?
So what's the answer?
Well, we're working on it, but we do think that, you know, things like exercise and diet, you know, you see it in the newspapers, you see it all the time. There's new research coming out, and we're behind a lot of that research that there may be a, you know, that they may have a big impact on the brain. And we think the reason, one of the underlying scientific reason may be those things are interventions that influence brain cell metabolism. And so, you know, at the same time, exercise and diet, if you eat right and you exercise, you're taking care of your body. We know that you're going to improve your body's health. What we're trying to understand is what's the impact on the brain? Is there a clear impact on the brain? How big of an impact? How can we use that better on a population basis? How can we get our patients to exercise and the healthy people in the out in the public to exercise more to prevent Alzheimer's disease? So
you think it really could be like a prevention issue as well?
Yes, that's probably, or in my opinion, that's the most exciting area in Alzheimer's research is the strides we're making in the area of prevention.
Because I think there is a sentiment of maybe almost inevitability about this, like some sort of switch gets flipped and it just happens. But it sounds like if we're talking about prevention, maybe not.
Right. Maybe not. You know, the way we think about it is if someone's destined to get the disease at the age of 75, and we don't really know who's destined to get it at 75, but if they are, if they eat right, if they exercise, they may push that onset back 5 years, 2 years, 5 years. It doesn't sound like a whole lot, but it is. If we can do that across the population, if we could delay the onset on average across the population 5 years, we would cut the disease prevalence in half. That's a huge impact. That would have a huge impact on a public health basis. So we think, you know, we can modify that onset. We can, through exercise and diet, modify, push it back a few years. You know, that's not the holy grail, of course, but it's a big step. And we can use it better. We need to use, I mean, from a public health perspective, we need to do more to get this message out there. I think we're doing a pretty good job of getting that message out there, but also engage people in an effective way. When I sit down with patients, I tell every single one of them to get more active physically and mentally. But I know that doesn't translate into behavior change. That doesn't translate into action. And so what we're trying, one of the themes that we're focusing on is how do we actually get people engaged? How do we write a prescription and get them to actually be more active and get the physical activity at the right dose and the right type that they need to have that brain benefit.
And that's a prescription you're writing?
Well, we're working on. We're trying to define what that prescription is. That's one of our goals, is to get to the point where we know exactly what somebody needs and what type so that we can get a known benefit. So, You know, the Holy Grail, though, of course, is not necessarily exercise. That's not the magic bullet. Exercise is not the magic bullet. It's not going to cure people, but we do believe it may slow it down. But understanding why it may slow it down and the you know, underlying biological mechanisms that slow it down through exercise or diet is important. We could then design better interventions, better drugs to take advantage of that information.
This might sound like a strange question, but you talked about the brain and what makes us human, so I think you're probably game. Does studying Alzheimer's shed light on how the brain works in general and even on the relationship between memory and personal identity?
Sure. I mean, yeah, you know, we learn about what the brain does by what it does wrong when somebody has a disease or a stroke or has an injury in you know, a certain part of the brain. And so, you know, understanding, you know, in some diseases, not Alzheimer's, but things like frontotemporal dementia, we see changes in an individual's morality, in an individual's personality.
Morality?
Yes.
Their decision-making.
Judgment and decision-making, impulsivity and the ability to override an impulse. And so it basically teaches us a lot about how the brain works and how our, you know, where in the brain or the regions in the brain that are involved in mediating these things that make us human.
But what about, yeah, like what makes me me and you you? I mean, if I have this sequence of events in my life that have created my belief systems and my my personality as I think of it, and then all of that changes, am I a new person? Am I what, you know?
Well, yeah, I'll try to stay out of the philosophical realm, but I can tell you that there are, one of the questions I ask people who have a family member with frontotemporal dementia is, are they a different person now? Are they the same person, you know, in general that they used to be? And almost everybody who has frontotemporal dementia, family member will say they are a completely different person, from their personality, you know, to how they behave and how they act. And it's frontotemporal dementia, we could talk about that for a long time. It's a very serious problem that tends to affect younger individuals in their 50s, sometimes their 40s, and affects everything about them from their style to their choice of, you know, food preferences, to how they behave and how they talk, et cetera. So really profound changes in personality and social behavior in individuals with frontotemporal dementia. And it teaches us and reminds us that the brain is mediating all these processes that make us human.
Well, yeah, Alzheimer's is definitely human and personal for anyone with a friend or relative who's been changed by the disease. Right now, there are more than 5 million people in the United States living with an Alzheimer's diagnosis, and that number is expected to double by the year 2050. Those are the numbers, but the displacement of memory isn't experienced by the numbers. It knows no time. Here's a story about a local man with Alzheimer's and his relationship to time, as told by his daughter Esther Honig, with Matthew Hodep and Patrick Quick.
Do you know where you were born?
Yeah, I was born in San Francisco.
Okay. And what, do you remember what year?
I think it was 1452.
Hey, Dad, do you know what day it is today?
Yeah. January 19th, 1951. I was born in January 19th, 1951.
This is my dad, Jordan Honig, and for the last 4 or 5 years, he's been displaced in time.
Do you remember when you first started to get Alzheimer's?
I didn't get Alzheimer's.
You didn't?
No.
You can almost say he's a time traveler because he slips through time and space. Sometimes you might even catch him in the present. But it depends, I guess. So for the past year, he's lived in a nursing home, and it's this tiny little corridor. It's the type of place where there's linoleum flooring and fluorescent lights, and there's hardly any windows. It's the sort of place where the scenery never really changes.
And anything important that we should know about this year, 1951?
There really was a big wave. I was the first person to start creating things to eat. Everything I could think of that you would need to be in an ark.
Huh. Oh, this is the Ark story.
Yes.
The story of the Great Ark.
Yes.
And then the tidal wave came. That was the tidal wave you were talking about earlier.
Yes, the tsunami.
And you had your Ark built.
Yes, the Ark was already built, and it's still running.
So he's talked about the Ark before. I started documenting my dad around the time that he was diagnosed when he was 60. And he's had these reoccurring themes. And one of them is the Great Flood, or maybe sometimes it's a tsunami wave, and the Ark. This is taped from him 4 years ago.
In your adolescence, you went to Israel too, didn't you?
Yes, I did. And we were looking at what was left of the Ark. And in the Ark, we found not just Israeli coins, but Bedouin coins.
He did actually go to Israel when he was out of college. But of course, finding the Ark is a bit of an elaboration. But at different stages, he's been building the Ark. Or maybe he's been searching for the Ark, but now he's progressed to sailing the Ark, and it's this need to escape the impending tsunami, this wave that's going to come at him and crash down over everything.
It was a way of keeping alive. Yes,
seems like that's kind of what's happening in your head a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
And as you got everything that you could onto mm-hmm. the Ark,
and then as the wave came, they go.
To lose my dad in this way makes me wonder, what is a person without time? Who do we become without a present or a past? Just lost at sea.
This story called The Time Traveler's Ark was produced by KCUR contributors Esther Honig, Matthew Hodap, and Patrick Quick. It won first place, actually, at an international radio competition called the 24-Hour Radio Race, where participating teams had 24 hours to tell a story about time travel. When Central Standard returns, we'll hear more stories about living with Alzheimer's, not just in labs and medical journals, but in real life. I'm Gina Kaufman, back in a minute. I'm Gina Kaufman, and you're listening to Central Standard on KCUR. We've just heard a heartbreaking and beautiful story about life with Alzheimer's, all about a man with the disease and his unconventional relationship with time. Something that goes unspoken in the story is how Alzheimer has affected this father-daughter relationship. That personal side of Alzheimer's is what we'll be talking about now. I'd like to welcome two guests to the studio. Sharon Ward is married to a man with Alzheimer's. His name is Bryce Jones, and Sharon is his caregiver. Good morning, Sharon.
Good morning. Thank you for having me here.
Thanks for joining us. When did you meet your husband?
My husband and I met in 2005. We were both volunteers at a nursing home, and we went out on several dates, and then we dated for 2 years, and we decided to get married, and we did. And then once we got married, shortly after that, my husband had been diagnosed with Alzheimer's, and it was the first 4 or 5 years. Everything was fine. There really wasn't too many problems. I would notice that he would have difficulty if we were out to dinner. He may have difficulty figuring out what a gratuity would be on the dinner or something like that.
Was that before the diagnosis?
No, this was after.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. And I just started noticing little things. One day he went to the dentist, and he drove himself to the dentist. And the dentist office called me, and they said, where's Mr. Jones? And I said, well, he should be there by now. Well, unfortunately, he got lost. So at that point, I decided it was time that he not drive himself anymore. And fortunately, he was very easy to give up his car keys. And so the car is still sitting in the garage, but he doesn't want to drive it. And because I think deep down, he's afraid to drive. I don't think that my husband realizes that he has Alzheimer's. He knows that he has a problem because he'll say, "Why am I so dumb? I can't figure this out." And you know, it's not that he's dumb. It's just that he has Alzheimer's.
Yeah. Was there anything you feared when you first heard the diagnosis that has turned out to be different than you expected?
Yeah, because when I first heard this, fortunately, it was a very gradual change because I thought, I can do this. I love this man. I can take good care of him. Not a problem. And I can do it all by myself. But you can't. You need to actively seek help, and the sooner the better. If somebody offers to help you, let them do it. Because, and like the doctor said, keep him busy, keep him engaged. And so we did. We had a volunteer activity every day of the week. And it got to a point where it was just wearing me out.
So it was surprising to you that just like your love and desire to be that person for him was not going to solve this problem.
No, it wasn't. And it took me several years before it dawned on me that I couldn't do this all by myself, that I needed help, and I needed help quickly, you know, because I was just wearing out. And when you get physically tired, then your patience starts to wear out.
What has changed for you or your husband that you wouldn't have even imagined before going through this? I mean, on just a human, like, small scale in your life?
Just the change in him. You know, here's your knight in shining armor that doesn't know what day it is, you know, and the one constant in his life is we've got a little cat that he's just crazy about, you know, and so he's always looking for Jack the cat. And that's a good thing because it gives him a purpose. I can't say enough good things about the Alzheimer's Association. They've done an excellent job of helping. They guide you to where you need to be because you know you need help. You just don't know where to go.
Well, we'll hear more of Sharon's story in a moment, but we're also joined by Marcia Bishop. She's in the early stages of her own Alzheimer's diagnosis. Marcia, I really appreciate your joining us today.
Well, thank you.
How long have you known that you have Alzheimer's?
About four years.
Is it something that you struggle to talk about and hear other people talking about, or are you at some kind of peace with the diagnosis and all its implications?
Well, when I was diagnosed, I told everybody in the world. I wanted everybody to know I have Alzheimer's. I don't know why I felt like I had to do that.
Well, maybe it's the reality you're living with, and you needed the rest of the world to be living with that too, right along with you. Mm-hmm. Well, how did people respond when you told them?
For the most part, they were good. They would ask questions, and I was felt that I could answer their questions. Maybe not, maybe, but
what was the most common question people asked you?
You can't be having Alzheimer's. You don't have Alzheimer's.
Are people telling you it's not true?
Yeah.
Wow.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you don't have Alzheimer's. You're still walking. You're still talking. You're still communicating. You're still loving life.
What was, with all that being true, what was tipping you off that you needed to go in and be consulting doctors and that something was amiss?
My husband is a very, you know, let's get it done person. And actually, he was out of town when I was, my daughter said, something's wrong. You know, we need to see what's going on. And she's the one that guided me or guided us to the doctor and to see what was going on.
Do you know what she had noticed?
Because I was driving. And I drove to her house a jillion times. And there's one time she called and she said, where are you at? And I said, I have no clue where I'm at.
And so, the getting lost was the big clue.
That was the big clue.
So far, I mean, you do seem to, yeah, be right with us in this conversation and everything. I mean, does there seem to be any rhyme or reason for what you remember, what is like before, and what is different, what gets lost?
It's kind of an up and down thing. There's days that you are on board, you know, everything's good. And then you'll have a day and you're going like, I don't remember that. How in the world could I have? No, I didn't do that, you know. And I kept a little notebook and I write things down, you know, and try to keep myself sane.
So you're kind of able to manage it by keeping track of things mm-hmm. that you might forget later.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. When you heard our reporter's story about her dad who has Alzheimer's, who's kind of lost his anchor in time and believes it's 1951, is there anything you relate to in that experience, or is that still unfathomable?
It's, well, I'm not sure. You know, I'm just going with the flow. You know, it's, there's good days, there's bad days, and there's fabulous days.
Earlier in the show, we talked with Dr. Jeffrey Burns, a professor of neurology at KU Med. He's still with us, and he'll be able to answer our questions. Jeff, what are you hearing in these stories so far?
Well, you know, one of the things I just heard, I think Sharon say, was about early diagnosis, about if we see some changes or suspect there's some changes, it's helpful to get in and get evaluated and be proactive. So we can make a diagnosis early, and we do have treatments. You know, so I think it's important to take advantage of that. You know, our treatments, there are drugs that treat Alzheimer's. I think we should consider Alzheimer's a treatable disorder. Can we cure it? Can we stop it? No. But we do have drugs that can help. The effect of the drugs is not enough. We're not satisfied with it, but they are effective, and they can help slow some of the symptoms of decline down. So
can doing something like what Marcia was just talking about, having a notebook and sort of keeping track of what's happened, is that helpful, or is that a stopgap measure? I mean,
well, yeah, so I thought that was a great point that Marcia made about using a notebook and finding ways to compensate. You know, individuals with Alzheimer's disease, you know, who are early in the disorder can still have a lot to offer, even in the moderate stages, have a lot to offer. And if they find ways to compensate, to write things down, there's, you know, they can stay very, very productive, come on radio shows and offer the world a perspective on Alzheimer's disease. That's incredibly important.
And I love hearing, Marcia, that you have fabulous days. I mean, do you find that people overlook that you might still have just great days?
It's never comes to, you know, nobody ever talks about it to me, you know, it's, you know, I go with my life and I like it.
That's awesome. Well, we've mentioned diagnosis just now, so I want to go ahead and bring Barbara in Kansas City in on this. Barbara, do you have a question about diagnosis?
Well, I do, because I was diagnosed with what they're calling mild cognitive impairment, or MCI, and it can, but not necessarily, lead to Alzheimer's. And the comment about keeping a notebook, I've started doing that and having not only the calendar on my desk, but the calendar in my pocketbook and trying. My family noticed it before I did. And when I told my friends, they said, well, what are you doing that we aren't doing? Like forgetting names and things like that. I'm 75 and lots of my friends forget names. So I didn't think much about it. And then apparently, I clearly was not aware of this, kept asking my family. I have one daughter who lives in Kansas City, another in Seattle, and obviously my husband is still alive. So he probably saw it first, but asked the girls, did I keep telling them the same things over and over again? Did I ask the same questions? Things like that. And apparently I do. I was totally unaware of it, although my father, though never diagnosed with anything like Alzheimer's or MCI, if they even called it that then, would tell us the same things over and over again, and we just laughed about it, didn't think anything about it. So when they told me I did that, I thought, well, so what?
Yeah. Barbara, I wonder what is your question about diagnosis?
Well, when I was diagnosed, all I was told was that it could lead to Alzheimer's. And I guess my concern is, does it always? Apparently not. But I would really like to hear from the doctor what his thoughts are about mild cognitive impairment. And is it something?
Let's go ahead and get that answer. Yeah. Thanks so much for calling.
Yeah, so I'm glad the caller's bringing this up, because MCI, or mild cognitive impairment, is a very important clinical diagnosis that we make frequently. And it's basically captures the idea of we're seeing some changes in memory. It's not far enough to be diagnosing somebody with Alzheimer's disease, but it's a little more than we expect with age. So it's kind of in between age and dementia or Alzheimer's disease.
Is there a scientific difference, or is it an observational difference?
Good question. And it's kind of an observational difference. We do have some tests that we'll give. I mean, in research, it's a little more structured, where on certain tests, somebody scores within this range and they meet the criteria. But in general, people with MCI don't have problems doing the things like balancing their checkbook or driving, finding their way around. They don't have significant changes in those areas of activities of daily living. So does everybody progress to Alzheimer's who has MCI? No. But the most common, you know, if we go 5 years into the future, over half do. But not everybody does. So it in many people is the earliest sign of Alzheimer's disease, but not everybody. There can be other things that cause MCI, like depression or low thyroid or low B12 or stroke, changes in the brain like that. So lots of causes. Alzheimer's is probably the number one cause of mild cognitive impairment.
I want to talk about relationships a little bit, because that keeps coming up. It's people's children or spouses who are noticing things. But once the disease is progressing, it seems like that would inevitably change a relationship pretty dramatically too. Sharon, how has your relationship with your husband changed? Can you talk to us about some of that?
Yeah, excuse me. It used to be early on in our relationship that he was the leader, and he would say, oh, we're going to go here for dinner and there for the show and blah, blah, blah. And that was fine. Now, the role is completely reversed. And, you know, unfortunately, my husband doesn't know what day it is or you know, what we're doing. And so it's gotten to a point now where, you know, I am his primary caregiver as well as everything else, you know. And it's just very sad to see. Like Marcia said, there are days where he will be, for 10 minutes, be himself and pat you on the hand and try to show some affection. And you just really cherish those moments, because they're not coming back again real soon.
Have your relationships with other people changed too?
Unfortunately, it does, hon. Because essentially, your friends don't know exactly how to cope with this person who has the disease. So consequently, they just ignore you. You know, you don't get invited to go out to dinner, you know, with folks that normally you would, once a month, you would go out to dinner and, you know, and have some laughs and so forth. They don't know how to react and to treat Bryce, so they just don't call. Yeah. So, you know, then you wind up and you make new friends with folks who have the disease as well. And then that way everybody's on the same playing field, and it works out better, you know, because you still have to have interaction with other folks, you know, you can't just be these two people together. So.
Jeff Burns, what is the relationship between relationships, friendships, and sort of, I don't know, managing this disease and managing its progress?
Yeah. So, I mean, this is a disease that affects the whole family. That, you know, obviously the individual that at the center has the disease, but the whole family unit is affected and is involved in the care, the diagnosis and the care. So very much personal relationships are important, and, you know, and providing the right care and the right environment, as Sharon's doing for her husband. It comes down to the family unit, and the social support around a family.
Yeah, you talked earlier about staying mentally active being something that delays the progress of the disease. Is friendship a form of staying mentally active?
Yes, social activity is a great way to stay mentally active, and then social support. A lot of research is ongoing now, looking at social support structures and interconnections with others. And while the disease does take away some of that social support, as Sharon just described, it's something we see in almost everybody or every family to some degree. But that social support is very important in the care of an individual with Alzheimer's.
Marcia, are you laying any kind of groundwork to help your own relationships through the next stages of Alzheimer's? I mean, is there even any way to do that? What are you doing now thinking about your relationships?
Well, I really don't want to think about it. But we're very active. You know, we have a dog, and so she has to be walked twice a day. And that's, you know, I'm always active. I'm always up and, you know, going around and being with friends. And I have some girls that always meet me, and we have lunch, and it's a long lunch.
That's awesome. Well, Central Standard is off to one last break this morning. We'll get right back to this conversation about the Alzheimer's journey. I'm Gina Kaufman. Don't go away. We're back. I'm Gina Kaufman, and today's Central Standard is all about Alzheimer's disease, from research to relationships. Our guests are caregiver Sharon Ward, neurologist, Jeff Burns, and Marcia Bishop, who has just been recently diagnosed with Alzheimer's disease. And we're going to get right to some calls, but Marcia, math has been something that's you've had an interesting relationship with since your diagnosis. Can you talk about what that means?
It's very frustrating because of, like, when I go to lunch with my friends, I have to say, will you help me figure out what I need to, what the tip is or how much I need to pay the whatever it is? And they're great, you know, about really being cautious. And see, so, you know, my husband, every day we get, he watches my checkbook just to make sure that I'm not spending money that needlessly, I guess.
So math is just kind of gone.
Yes.
Jeff Burns, is there a scientific explanation for this?
Oh, yeah. This is something we look for and see. One of the areas that's affected by Alzheimer's disease is the parietal region of the brain, and that's the region where calculations are mediated in large part. And so, we can see, you know, it's not just a memory disease, but we see problems in calculation and other what we call cognitive domains.
Let's talk to Stuart in Shawnee. Hi, Stuart.
Hello there. How are you today?
Pretty good. Can you tell us?
This is a wonderful show.
Thank you.
I told your person about my circumstances here. My mom made it to 93 and only had short-term memory loss. Dad, when he died at 90, was essentially a zombie. That's about 15, 20 years ago. And I was wondering if I should go to KU. I live in Shawnee. If I should go to KU and get tested. The thing is, I don't know if I want to find out. As I speak, I'm driving Meals on Wheels right now, and I haven't gotten lost yet.
Well,
so I'm pretty active.
Stuart, you raise...
I'm 77 years old.
Yeah, you raise a couple of interesting questions. One seems to be about heredity, and the other seems to be, what about knowing versus not knowing? Is this even a question?
Oh, yeah, these are big questions. Well, first, I'd say you haven't inherited the Alzheimer's gene. You've inherited the longevity gene. And so, you know, you got a dad who lived to 90 and a mom who lived to 93. So the chances of you living into your 90s is high. Now, with that comes a high risk of Alzheimer's disease. For anyone. People in their 90s, probably one out of two individuals who get to 90 will have memory problems.
Whoa.
So your risk is high, but primarily because of the longevity. And then, you know, the question, do you want to know, is a big one. But then we got to break that down. Know what? We have these risk factors, and we have these new scans that we talked about earlier that can tell us a little bit better how high somebody's risk might be. We're not good enough to tell you exactly how high it is or what the time frame is, but it's, it is a big question. And we're using that. I guess I'd encourage you to think about going into research, getting involved in a research study. We're doing a study at KU right now where we're doing those brain scans. We're telling people if they have an elevated amyloid or an elevated risk of Alzheimer's or not. And if they do have an elevated risk, we're trying to determine what's the next step. What can we do about it? At this point, we don't know, or we haven't proven that we can impact the disease or prevent it, but we believe we can. And so we're testing that through exercise and drug studies, that if we know that kind of information, we can actually do something about it. That's where we're headed.
Let's hear from Becca in North Kansas City. Hi, Becca.
Hi. I just wanted to share with you how things began with my mother. We first started noticing the repeating of ideas and sort of themes that looped. And then the next thing was she became very passionate about a lot of these themes, inappropriately angry in a lot of cases, about things that had no impact on her. For instance, gays in the military. But every conversation, you know, would come back to these things that angered her. And somehow I came up with an idea of distraction from reading a book on Alzheimer's. And what I did was I made a little trivia book, and each page had a question on it, and it was questions about either her childhood or her early years, all things that she remembered and enjoyed answering. And even where did you learn to drive a car? What's your sister's middle name? What is your favorite color? And I mean, even if she did answer a question incorrectly, I'd just say, that's right, you know. And she felt so good. It totally turned her mood around, because it really bothered her that she didn't have answers to a lot of the questions that people were asking her at this time.
Becca, thank you so much. We're running short on time, so I want to get the doctor's response to this story.
Yeah, so that's great. I think it's great advice that you're given, that sort of redirecting or distracting away from sort of a problem behavior, or somebody's obsessing about something that's made them angry or they're getting agitated. The best medicine is no medicine. It's redirection and trying to distract. There are times where that doesn't work, and then we go to medicines, but I think that's an important point that Beck is making.
Sharon Ward, has that been your experience too as a caregiver?
Yes, it has, very much.
Well, our time for today's show on Alzheimer's is running to a close, but I just want to thank everyone. This has been an amazing and really personal conversation, and hopefully, we'll get more of these stories down the road. Jeff Burns with us from the University of Kansas Alzheimer's Research Center. Thanks for your time and expertise.
Thank you, Gina.
Sharon Ward, thanks for sharing your story. We'll be thinking of you and your husband.
Thank you very much.
And Marcia Bishop, best of luck to you on your journey. It was really courageous of you to have this conversation with us, and we hope you'll stay in touch.
We will. Thank you very much.
Since this show originally aired back in September, a few things have changed. Jeff Burns, the researcher who spoke with us, says there have probably never been more trials for treatments that can be used in the later stages of Alzheimer's. And at KU, they have a new prevention trial starting soon. Meanwhile, Sharon had her husband admitted to a facility specializing in Alzheimer's care in January of this year. She visits him every other day, but he doesn't seem to know she's his wife. He's never called her by name or asked when he can come home. It's super sad, but for Sharon, that's also validation that it was time. Central Standard is produced by Matthew Long Middleton and Sylvia Maria Gross. I'm Gina Kaufman, and that's a wrap. Up to Date is next. Don't miss it.